everyone, it's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm doing great. I'm a little tired, so, you know, drinking an espresso, but yep. It's good.
It's fine. We're recording this a little late, but that's fine. Busy schedules.
Yeah.
We made it work.
Yep.
But I am very excited about this week's episode. It's one of the artists where I wish I could talk about all her pieces, but that would take hours and hours. So I have condensed it into 35 to 45 minutes.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect. I'm excited from some of the images that you've shown me and that we've posted mm-hmm. so far. They look very cool. I'm excited to hear more. So
yes,
I'm ready.
I'm really looking forward to it. All right, so I guess might as well jump right in.
Yeah.
So Mona Khatoum. She was born in 1952, and she is a Palestinian-British sculptor and multimedia artist, utilizing sculpture and video to discuss issues of gender and inequality that she's experienced not just in the Middle East, but globally. Khatoum began her life in exile. So, but as with many Palestinians after the conflict in 1948, her parents fled their home in Haifa, which I found out is where my grandmother is from.
Oh.
Yeah. So her parents fled there. She's the youngest of three siblings, three daughters. And on the topic of, you know, where she was from and after fleeing the country. So I had a conversation with my mom about this after the episode of Emily Jalsid. And, you know, she was telling me that the Lebanese president at the time, Sulayman Frangieh, in the 70s, he favored Christian Palestinians over Muslim ones. So he only gave the Christian Palestinians Lebanese citizenship for political gain.
Oh,
but Muslim
God.
Palestinians didn't get it.
Oh.
Yes, that was in the 70s. I don't know how her parents were affected prior to that because they moved to Lebanon in the 1950s. She mm-hmm. was born in Lebanon. But neither she nor her parents at the time were able to get the Lebanese citizenship. Wow. I don't know whether if it was because they were Christian or Muslim. It's unclear in any of the articles I found about her.
Oh, my God. That's...
Yeah.
Wow. So then the Palestinians were just living in Lebanon.
Exile.
Okay.
Yeah, and just...
Wow.
You know, they couldn't get the citizenship. The only reason why my grandma became Lebanese was because our family's Christian.
Oh my gosh.
I know, yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I didn't know this until my mom told me about it, so I just figured I'd share that bit of information.
Yeah.
But yeah, it explains a lot about Khatoum's feelings about identity, which I'll get into later.
Mm-hmm.
But so yeah, she was born in Beirut. Her parents were actually not very supportive of her desire to become an artist. And, you know, the lack of art classes in Lebanon didn't really help. She essentially taught herself. She would draw, she'd doodle in her school books. She spent a lot of time studying European paintings from books independently. She studied graphic design at the Beirut University College and continued with that course of study for 2 years before getting a job at an advertising agency. And, you know, this work was very unsatisfying, very disheartening for her. So to reevaluate what she wanted to do in life, she decided to take a trip to London in 1975. In 1975, the Lebanese Civil War broke out. So she was stuck in London. She could not come back.
Oh my
so God. Essentially, she was forcibly exiled a second time. Yeah. Thankfully, a silver lining in this is that her father worked at the British Embassy in Beirut, and he had the forethought of securing citizenships for himself, his wife, and the three daughters. So at least when she was there, she was able to stay there without worrying about citizenship issues.
That's good. So she was able to get a British citizenship? Is that
yes.
What, okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, but yeah, so the war broke out. She couldn't go back home. She was stuck there.
Wow.
But, you know, she embraced the opportunity and was able to fully pursue her art career there, more so than in Lebanon. She studied at both the Biam Shah School of Art and the Slade School of Fine Art between the years of 1975 and 1981. At the same time, she joined many feminist groups and engaged in political debates with her peers, all of which reflected most in her work while she was at the Slade. During her university years, she was also praised and linked to like conceptual art, to minimalism, which you can kind of sense in some of her sculptures and installation pieces.
Yeah.
But she did feel confined by the strict rules of British art schools, which is unsurprising. Performance pieces were really what provided her with a sense of liberty and freedom and kind of the opportunity to rebel and realign those boundaries. And, you know, you will get to see that quite a bit in her pieces. As always, with an artist who happens to be a woman, who happens to be Middle Eastern, her identity is often used to label her work. And she has expressed her frustrations about this. One article I found really interesting was an interview she had with the artist Janine Antoni. She said very poignantly in that interview, "I'm often asked the same question, what in your work comes from your own culture? As if I have a recipe and I can actually isolate the Arab ingredient, the woman ingredient, the Palestinian ingredient. People often expect tidy definitions of otherness, as if identity is something fixed and easily definable." Hmm. Yeah, and the minute I read that, I'm like, oh my god, she is such a badass.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, especially how she's like, I don't have a recipe for this. There aren't ingredients of specific identities in my work. It's so much more than that. And in that same interview, she talks about her life growing up, you know, how the frustrations of displacement affected her, how she's especially bothered by the inconsistencies of people in labeling her. Mm. Many refer to her as Lebanese. And, you know, of course, she denies this strongly, reminding Janine of the majority of Palestinians post-1948 not being able to obtain Lebanese identity cards. It's one way of discouraging them from integrating fully into the Lebanese situation. So she was never, she was there, but she wasn't Lebanese, you know, right. And she would never have felt that way. She also remembers how isolating it was being stranded in London once the civil war in Lebanon broke out. And she says it kind of added a different sense of dislocation on top of the one she already felt as an individual in exile back in Lebanon.
I'm sure, because it's like you're first forced to leave your home country and then the new one that you have kind of adopted.
You're forced out of.
Again, yeah.
Yeah.
That's awful. I'm sure it's hard to wrap your head around too. Right. Like, where are you really supposed to go back to? That's kind of like air quotes, but like, where are you supposed to go back to? Like, what is your real home, or like, where is your real place of origin?
Exactly. And you know, this is what she kind of focuses on more so than a specific identity in her work. She essentially describes her life as manifesting into her heart in a manner of disjunction. There's constant motion in her pieces. There are unsettling compositions, an environment that's in constant flux. There is a sense of instability, of restlessness, and you can see that in the images. Mm. In the same breath, however, she asserts that this stems not just from her Middle Eastern identity, as most people assume, but also it's informed by her life in the West. You know, she's quoted saying in that same interview, "I'm speaking of encountering architectural and institutional structures in Western urban environments that are about the regimentation of individuals, fixing them in space and putting them under surveillance. What I'm trying to say here is that the concerns in my work are as much about the facts of my origins as they are a reflection on or an insight into the Western institutional power structures I have found myself existing in for the last 20 odd years."
Wow.
Yeah. I know. She really went for it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that, because as with many artists who live in exile, I feel like critics in the West for the most part kind of brand them as strictly Middle Eastern, you know, as their work commenting strictly on Middle Eastern issues. But that is not the case, you know. Yeah. Most of their life is in the West.
Right.
You know, Saida lived most of her life in the U.S. Rania Matar lived most of her life in the U.S. Many other artists I've talked about traveled so much. You know, they have exposure to Western culture and they critique that in their work as well.
Yeah.
You know, the West isn't this pristine place where they can escape from their problems in the Middle East. There's problems in the West as well.
Yeah, and just because you're from somewhere doesn't mean you should be limited to talking about exactly. just that place. Like, I mean, even like me, like I shouldn't be limited to learning about American art. Like, there's right. so much else out there that you shouldn't have to only comment about where exactly. you're from.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I remember one professor in undergrad, when I started expressing interest in Middle Eastern art, she kind of warned me. She's like, just remember that once you pick this, people are going to label you as this for the rest of your career. So just yeah. make sure this is what you want. And she's right. You know, I'm Lebanese. I'm choosing to research Middle Eastern artists. And this is because I love kind of the sense of, I don't know, empathy that I share with the artists I research. So mm-hmm. that's just my choice. And it's the choice that I'm making knowing that I'll probably be labeled as just someone who knows about Middle Eastern art and nothing else, you know? But
yeah.
that is the risk.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm sure for you as well, like, it's also coming more from a place of, like, because you can maybe empathize with some of the mm-hmm. these artists more, you also can better articulate and give more
right.
more context for these artists who in previous years or publications, whatever, like people may have said they're only like talking about Middle Eastern issues yeah. and you'll be able to show no they're doing so
there's
much
a different
more
side
too.
To this right
yeah, yeah.
this so, is, that is hopefully what I would like to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is what she says. And so to dive more into the artistic aspect of her career, fast forward to 1984, she was awarded a residency in Vancouver, British Columbia, where her work caught the eye of the curator of the Pompidou Centre. Her name was Miss Vanache, if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. But it's V-A-N, and her last name is A-S-S-C-H-E.
Okay.
So she, under that residency program, produced several works, and eventually this resulted in her first Pompidou-supported show in 1997 at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago.
Oh, so, cool.
I know, that was exciting to find out.
Yeah.
It also happened to be the first American survey of her work.
Oh,
that
wow.
exhibit. Yeah. And it's such a fascinating exhibit when you look at it. It featured, at the time, her most recent installation pieces, films, and photographs. There was a large arrangement of steel bunk beds, of cubes covered in iron fillings, all of which I'll talk about. Most notably, the piece Socle du Monde, which is translated to Base of the World. She did this one between 1992 and 1993. And if you look at pictures of this one, for those who want to know, the cube is found in the first series of posts on Hatoum. But it's huge. It's very black. It essentially mm-hmm. just absorbs light. And it physically dominates the gallery space that it's in. It pays explicit homage to Piero Manzoni, who was an Italian avant-garde artist whose work was most often compared to that of Yves Klein, which makes sense when you look at the cube because the material on the outside of it is very textured, very similar to how textured Yves Klein's work was, and I'm assuming Manzoni's was. It also related to themes of Eva Hesse and minimalism with industrial forms. Again, makes sense because it's made of steel.
Mm-hmm.
The cube itself, the underlying structure of it is constructed of mild steel. And then Hatoum coated it in a material that adhered to the metal surface, creating this kind of very organic-looking pattern. Mm-hmm. It almost seems alive.
Yeah.
And this one article that I found describes it like rippling intestines or sea urchins.
Yes.
Right?
I was kind of thinking they looked like intestines.
I know, that's what I thought. Or like the kind of the brain.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that too.
Yeah, and the article continues and says, you know, on closer inspection, and again, all of these articles that I'll be mentioning will all be listed in the link tree of sources that'll be up for you to look at. But on closer inspection, this kind of energetic surface reveals itself to be made up of millions of iron fillings, and their formations are determined by kind of a network of magnets that Hatun placed on the inner surface of the cube.
Oh, wow.
Right. So, and when you look at it going back to the idea of a pattern resembling intestines, it's almost like it is a body turned inside out, which kind of creates this sense of unease for the viewer. You know, as Hatun described her work as being, you know, like unsettling environments, an environment in constant flux. This is what that cube demonstrates.
Mm-hmm.
And, but at the same time, it's kind of a paradox because that material, the organic exterior of it, is very enticing, I think, to the viewer. You want to get closer to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting dynamic where it's very unsettling, but you can't help but want to approach it.
You said that it is very large. Do you mm-hmm. know, like, exactly, like, how tall it is? Do you know?
Yes, so it is roughly 64 by 78 by 78 inches.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doing the mental math. Okay, so it's like as tall as a person.
Essentially, yes.
Wow.
All okay. around. Yeah. And if people are listening back home, I know you prefer the metric system. It's 164 by 200 by 200 centimeters. So a very tall person. Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And, you know, the magnetic fields, they cause the fillings to ripple and reorder. So, yeah, the pattern is constantly in motion. I don't know if I can find a clip of it, but if I can, I will post that as well.
Oh, my gosh.
If not, I apologize. Maybe some of the listeners can find it as they look up the artist. But, yeah, you know, in this way, Hatun is implying instability of mm-hmm. estrangement, creating this kind of uncanny sense in her audience that appearances can be deceptive.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. That's really cool. I mean, like,
It is very cool.
It already is, like, very interesting to look at, but then knowing, too, that it's just constantly changing, too.
Right.
That's wild.
Yeah. So this piece is an example of one of her sculptures, but she also does others that are kind of, they have similar themes, but they're done differently. So one of them, this is years later in 2008, it's titled Daybed. And this is the first picture and the first series of posts from our Instagram. It's black finished steel, and it kind of demonstrates a very twisted, almost threatening source of relief from any feelings of fatigue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a play on words, which Hatun enjoyed, kind of like the humor of that and the irony of it. If you think daybed, you think nap, relaxation, you know, but the object itself looks very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Extremely uncomfortable. So there's two sets of perforations, and they're inspired by a box grater. And the way that they're spaced out and their size, They are supposed to resemble a pillow and a blanket. Yeah.
Yeah.
The perforations, I believe, on the blanket are a little larger than the ones on the pillow. But in any case, yeah, not something you want to take a nap on. she takes this utilitarian object that we're familiar with, that we use in the kitchen, and transforms it into something meant for leisure, but is in fact anything but.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting looking at these types of pieces that she's done. Another one that she did was called No Way 4 from 2013. It's a repurposed colander that she presents flipped upside down, and there's dowels or like small rods protruding from the holes. So it's essentially destroying its original purpose as an appliance, mm-hmm. as a colander. So I found those very fascinating, and I couldn't help but think of surrealism and, like, you know, a lot of them using found objects and repurposing them to kind of destroy that original meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her work, these specifically, have been compared to surrealism. I don't know what she has to say about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if she said that she was kind of inspired by this method of found objects and repurposing them.
Yeah.
And actually, which I was very happy to find out, Edward Said, who's, you know, a very well-known Palestinian scholar and historian. I don't know if you have, but I've read a few of his essays in some of our classes.
I think so. I recognize the name.
So he wrote an essay about her work.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and God, I'm so excited to have university access again to libraries and look up the article. But for now, I have a quote from the article that I found through an article. But he says this about these types of sculptures of hers. Domesticity is thus transformed into a series of menacing and radically inhospitable objects whose new and presumably non-domestic use is waiting to be defined. Mm. They are unredeemed things whose distortions cannot be sent back for correction or reworking, since the old address is unreachably there and yet has been annulled. Which I love his wording. He's such a great writer. Mm-hmm. But I love that the old address of this object, its original purpose, it's there. You can recognize where it's from, but at the same time, it's been annulled. It's not there anymore. You don't know what this object is.
Yeah.
It's, which is so interesting to me.
It's, there was like another word that popped into my head. I think like uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that could maybe describe it.
Yeah.
As sure. Well, of like feeling like you know what it is, but then it's like there's something not quite right.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, uncanny is a great word to use because, again, in one of the articles, it says she creates the uncanny sense in her audience that appearances can be deceptive. So, yeah, essentially, the function of daybed is unclear, and Hatoum challenges viewers to adapt to objects in their new setting and rethink their original definition, which, yet again, is quite surrealist of her, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what she has to say about that, so I won't label her. So this is apparent in several of her sculptures, including the colander. There's one image that I posted. It's of a chair, but it's made of barbed wire. So this is a very common theme. So those are some of her sculptures. Her films are also incredibly moving. One specifically had been featured in that same exhibition in Chicago. It's called Measures of Distance, and she did it in 1988. It's 15 minutes long, and it demonstrates the power and liberty that Hatoum felt through performance art. So, unlike her usual stance on identity and its impact on her work, this film is very autobiographical. It's incredibly intimate. I don't think you can find something more intimate than this film in her body of work. It's surprising, honestly, but it directly speaks of the displacement, the disorientation, and the tremendous sense of loss as a result of separation caused by war.
Mm.
So the background images that are just playing across the 15-minute video are slides that Hatoum took of her mother in the shower, which the artist took during a visit to Lebanon. Wow. So this is after the Civil War broke out. She was able to visit, and I was surprised when I saw, I mean, so my mom and I have a very open relationship, right? And I feel like this is something that has changed across generations, especially in Lebanese culture, or I guess Arab culture.
Mm.
So it really took me by surprise that there was such a level of comfort between Hatoum and her mom in the 80s. You know, that's kind of, I don't know, it's very interesting. But so, yeah, she was taking a shower. So it's her mother's in the nude in this film.
Wow.
And the images are on top of them. There's Arabic text. And they're actually letters that were written by Hatoum's mother to Hatoum whenever they were apart.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
That's so sweet.
Right? And throughout the film, there are two audios. One of them is Hatoum and her mom having very intimate conversations. Her mother is openly talking about her feelings, her sexuality, her husband's objections to Hatoum's intimate observation of her naked body. And the second one is of Hatoum herself reading the English translated versions of the letters on the screen.
Oh, wow.
Right. And what's very interesting about them is that the conversation with her mom is in Arabic, but she's reading the letters in English. But both of those are played at equal volumes, so it kind of forces a Western viewer who can't speak Arabic to have to strain to fully comprehend the situation.
Yeah.
Which I think is a bold move on her part. Mm-hmm. I think it's smart. It kind of breaks this stereotype of Western culture, especially across colonial history, invading the privacy and just invading the space of non-Western countries. So I think it's interesting that she kind of puts them at the same volume and just makes the person who can't speak Arabic have to pay more attention mm-hmm. in order to fully understand.
When you watched the film, like, mm-hmm. as someone, you know, who can speak and understand Arabic and English, like, how was that for you? Was it weird to, like, be listening to one conversation weird, yeah. and then another?
Yeah, I know. It really depended on what I was curious about. A yeah. part of it, sometimes I'm like, oh, I want to know what this letter says. And then the other is like, oh, but I want to hear what she and her mom are talking about. And then I think, oh, but I can read the letters.
Oh, my
but
God.
Then it's a lot happening, which... Yeah. Again, plays into this theme that she has of her work being very disorienting,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
it's the same thing. And so this is what she says about the film. Although the main thing that comes across is a very close and emotional relationship between mother and daughter, it also speaks of exile, displacement, disorientation, and a tremendous sense of loss as a result of the separation caused by war. In this work, I was also trying to go against the fixed identity that is usually implied in the stereotype of Arab woman as passive, mother as non-sexual being. Mm. The work is constructed visually in such a way that every frame speaks of literal closeness and implied distance. Which I think is really interesting because, again, you know, in my mind, and this is just something that I'm trying to unlearn after having grown up in Lebanese culture. At first I thought, oh, this is weird. Like an Arab mom and an Arab daughter being so close in the 80s. Uh-huh. She disrupts that stereotype, right? Mm. And she makes the mom as a sexual woman who's openly talking about her sexuality and about her feelings. She's not passive. She plays a very active role in this film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's that intimate aspect of it. And then the text on top of her mom's body, it's almost like a veil or a barbed wire. That's what it's often compared to in many articles. And mm-hmm. it kind of prevents total visual access. And
yeah.
So the Tate, which has quite a few of her works on their website, describes this kind of text as both concealing and revealing the woman inhabiting that body,
mm.
explicating her as an active thinking and feeling being, an image which is emphasized by the frank conversation about her sexuality with her daughter. So, yeah, it's very interesting. And inherently, the work breaks these taboos surrounding the maternal body, where the mother is kind of able to cement her identity independently of colonial and kind of patriarchal standards of what she's meant to be or meant to look like or meant to talk about, even.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the film.
Wow, that's... very cool. It's like layered on so many levels, like between the visual and the audio too.
Literally and metaphorically, it's just layers upon layers in this film. And it is on YouTube, so I will include the link to that in the link tree for people to watch.
Nice.
If anyone's interested. But yeah, so that's one of her films. And so at this point, I've talked about kind of her sculptures and her installation pieces, many of which don't comment specifically on Middle Eastern issues. You know, it's just kind of a more global comment on kind of institutional violence. And then the film is very intimate in terms of her relationship to her mom. One final piece I wanted to comment on was Present Tense, which she produced in 1996. This one is, again, kind of uncanny in the sense that Hatoum is very open about her opinions here, specifically when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So she was actually invited to Palestine, to the Anadiel Gallery in East Jerusalem, and she made this work specifically for that exhibit. And she very tellingly reveals her stance on the conflict. It's a floor-level sculpture. It's made of 2,200 square blocks of Nablus soap.
Oh.
Yep. Into which Hatoum has pressed tiny red beads to outline a map of the Middle East. The beads show the map drawn up at the Oslo Peace Agreement of 1993 between Palestinian and Israeli authorities to demarcate land to be returned to Palestine. So the reason why the soap is so important, it's a traditional Palestinian product, and it made its way to Lebanon. I mean, I'm so familiar with this type of soap. It's just made purely of olive oil. It's what we used for almost everything, really. Mm-hmm. And it originated in the city of Nablus in the 10th century and continues to this day.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a very important part of Palestinian culture. And Hatoum's cartography, which she, in many other works that she's done, maps do play a role in her pieces. So, again, according to the Tate on their website, this cartography highlights the ephemeral state of recent territorial remapping, while on the other hand, reflecting the persistent and lasting history of the Palestinian people.
Mm.
Right? So you have this kind of the issue of territorial remapping, of what parts of land belong to whom, but the fact that it's on soap, on Nablus soap, it's a reminder that Palestinian people are there to stay. Their culture is very much present and alive no matter what can be done. And another thing that's been pointed out, which I also thought was interesting, there's again a play on words with the title, right? So the curator of Pompidou Centre actually talked about this. You know, you have, when you think of the term present tense, you can think of it as Hatoum is showing the present situation of Palestine, right? According mm-hmm. to the maps that were drawn up in 1993. Or another way to read it is the present tension. Like it's presently tense in the country, right? So it's read it as you will, kind of, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trip to Palestine for this exhibit and the piece itself were a very emotional process for her. It was her first time going there and also her first time meeting family members she had never seen before.
Wow.
Yeah. So of the piece, she says, it's really a map about dividing and controlling the area. At first sign of trouble, Israel practices the policy of closure. They close all the passages between the areas so that the Arabs are completely isolated and paralyzed. The Palestinians who came into the gallery recognized the smell and the material instantly. I saw the soap as a symbol of Palestinian resistance. The map looks like hundreds of little islands with no continuity or territorial integrity amongst them.
Yeah, when I was first looking at the images, I wasn't entirely sure what it is. Like, it does kind of look like a map, but I was like, I don't really recognize any of it, but...
Right.
Wow. Yeah, it's...
And I love that... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. I was just going to say kind of briefly that it really is amazing, like, how you think of maps and borders as being so immovable because they're, like, these, like, bigger, like, larger than life sort of things because there's no, like, there's usually no physical mark of them. But it, I mean, people just, you know, draw them up sometimes it seems like randomly and it affects, it affects real people. And it's just, it's kind of mind blowing if you, like, actually think about it.
Right. It's like, it's kind of like the blocks of soap. You can add more blocks. You can remove them too. Mm-hmm. It's really, there's no, the concept of territory is essentially, it was born out of colonialism and this desire to have power over land. This isn't how the human race started. You know, we just migrated from one place to another without thinking about this.
Right.
And now it's just, it's so deeply ingrained in us, right? This this fight for territory. So, I don't know. It's a, it's very interesting, and she I think she comments on it really well.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, in kind of conclusion, Hatoum's work is obviously incredibly vast, covers very different themes. all are a result of her ever-changing and influx state of being throughout her career and her life. And again, I wish I could talk about more of them because there's so many. I'll post as many as I can. But really, her installation work is just so incredible. I love that, you know, she's very consistent. I don't know what her most recent works have been. I don't know if she's produced anything recently.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent image I have on our Instagram was of 2017.
Okay.
But I'll keep digging. But yeah, I'm happy to know that she's still here. She's still practicing her work, and it has such an impact on so many people. And, you know, this is a very long quote, but I couldn't bring myself to cut it down. I just figured I'd finish off the episode with it.
Mm-hmm.
So in her interview with Janine Antoni, Antoni asked her, "What role do you want your art to play? And what role do you feel the art world has cast you in?" So I thought that was a very interesting question.
Yes.
So this is why I attached her entire answer. So this is what she says. "I want the work, in the first instance," so what role she wants her art to play, "to have a strong formal presence, and through the physical experience to activate a psychological and emotional response. In a very general sense, I want to create a situation where reality itself becomes a questionable point, where one has to reassess their assumptions and their relationship to things around them. A kind of self-examination and an examination of the power structures that control us. Am I the jailed or the jailer? The oppressed or the oppressor? Or both? I want the work to complicate these positions and offer an ambiguity and ambivalence rather than concrete and sure answers. An object from a distance might look like a carpet made out of lush velvet, but when you approach it, you realize it's made out of stainless steel pins, which turns it into a threatening and cold object rather than an inviting one. It's not what it promises to be. So it makes you question the solidity of the ground you walk on, which is also the basis on which your attitudes and beliefs lie. When my work shifted from the obviously political, rhetorical attitude into bringing political ideas to bear through the formal and the aesthetic, the work became more of an open system. Since then, I've been resisting attempts by institutions to fix the meaning in my work by wanting to include it in very narrowly defined theme shows."
Wow.
So that is the quote. As you can see, I could not cut
any of
that. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I feel like it sums it up perfectly. Like what?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's kind of how I felt just doing research on her. I know. I was so excited. I'm like, oh my God, I wish I could put more.
Yeah.
But I think this sums her up fairly well.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Awesome. Well.
Yeah, that is Mona Hatoum.
Very, very cool. Very, right? Just, I think you said earlier, badass. And
yes.
Yeah.
She very much is. When we made our first post, I had one of our listeners, he's actually a very close friend of my mom's. He's like, "Oh my God, she's one of my favorites. I love that you guys are talking about her." So that made me even that's more exciting. Excited.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So shout out to you, sir. You know who you are. But yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. And thank you, Jordan, for listening specifically.
Oh, of course. Of course. I was, excited to learn about her.
Yeah. So tell us, who are you talking about next?
So for next episode, I am going to be talking about a Danish contemporary artist. Mm-hmm. His name is Rune Bosse, and I probably did not do the best job of pronouncing his name, but
that's okay.
He's very cool. He currently works now based in Denmark, maybe in Copenhagen. I don't know. I'll check on that.
Oh, okay.
But he, you know, does a lot of stuff related to the environment, a lot of
exciting
installation and site-specific works.
Mm-hmm.
And I have reached out to him to potentially interview him, but he responded to me and let me know that he recently became a new father.
Aww.
So, yeah. So he was like, now is not the best time just because, you know, he's spending time with his new baby and
of
his
course,
family.
Fair.
So,
yeah.
So totally understandable, but I still want to talk about him because his work is cool. So, yes,
and hopefully the episode will get to him somehow and he will listen
yes.
to it.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, perfect. So that'll be next week.
All right, I'm excited.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's all for today. We will see you all in 2 weeks.
Yes. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.